We didn't get all those lovely questions on our podcast. So, all right. Well, have to remember to do that next time. The concept of class compromise. So this is a difficult set of issues. My own theoretical work on this has been largely formulated at the level of abstraction of capitalists and workers. That is, I've framed this problem of class compromise at the level of the game itself. So you have two categories, capitalists and workers. And the question is, what kinds of class formations occur within them, and what's the form of struggle between capital and labor? So that's at the level of the game itself. And when I discuss variations in the rules of the game, I still pretty much keep the two-actor model. So it's a kind of shifting from the game itself to the rules of the game, but not adding all the additional complexities of there being, you know, segments of classes and contradictory class locations and all these other complications around explaining variations in the rules of the game. It was complicated enough just to carry the theoretical argument through with this much simpler two-class model. And that's pretty much also the way, for this part of his discussion, Adam Shavorsky talks about these issues. All right, so I'm going to... This lecture mostly follows along the lines of Adam Shavorsky. That's how you pronounce it, by the way. The P-R-Z-E-W is just sure, you know, there's a kind of P at the beginning that you don't actually say, but it's not just Shavorsky, it's Shavorsky. You sort of have the shadow of a P at the beginning of it, Shavorsky, but it's not Pshavorsky. If any of you have Polish heritage, you will know the difficulty of speaking in English with all those consonants packed together in the beginning of Polish names. Adam Shavorsky is a professor originally at the University of Chicago, now at Columbia.
NYU.
NYU. He was originally from Poland, came to the United States in the 1970s, and has stayed since. I think his work on his social democracy and on the kind of problem of understanding the robustness of capitalism from the point of view of the nature of its class conflicts and its political settlements, I myself think it's the most interesting work along those lines. Certainly extremely influential for the way I think about these issues. He was a member of the No Bullshit Marxism group, the analytical Marxism group that I've been involved in since the early 1980s. He was a member in the 80s and 90s, but then he quit in the mid-90s. Jan Elster and Shavorsky both left the group. I don't know if I mentioned this vignette to you. Okay, so you already know the story. So Shavorsky, this is my reconstruction of his arguments. I think it's faithful to what he has to say, but he doesn't say it quite this way. I think there are two core theses that he adopts, which I call the class compromise thesis and the transition cost thesis. The class compromise thesis says, under certain conditions, if workers and capitalists act rationally in the pursuit of economic interests, they will converge on a class compromise form of class conflict. So if they're both acting rationally, and they're restricting their struggles to questions of economic interests in a straightforward way, you know, not some fancy postmodernist interpretation of what we mean by that, just straightforward. They're interested in their material interests in a conventional sense of, so they're rational. They don't have illusions. They don't make mistakes of a cognitive character. But they're also not motivated by values and interests other than economic interests. So if that's the case, then under certain conditions, the form of class conflict that will become stabilized can be called a class compromise. And the transition cost thesis says once a class compromise is reached, so once you are in that world where a class compromise, even a fairly weak one, occurs, then the transition costs involved in a socialist rupture will always be sufficiently high to make it economically irrational for workers to struggle for socialism. If there's a stable class compromise, and if the struggles are over material interests, then the struggle for socialism is irrational. That is, it's self-defeating. You know, it's a waste of time. It'll raise costs, impose deficits on your material interests without accomplishing anything. Irrational in that sense. Now, it wouldn't be irrational to struggle for socialism if there were things other than your material interests that you were concerned about. You know, if you were concerned about the quality of life of community, the sense of dignity and mutual respect, the the autonomy of people to flourish in the ways they liked. I mean, there'd be all sorts of things you could care about other than just the bread and butter material interests, which could say, yes, in terms of those values, then a struggle for socialism isn't irrational. But if the struggle is over exploitation, material conditions of life, to be even simpler about it, wages and benefits, if that's what you're struggling about, wages and benefits, then an attempt at a rupture with capitalism is not rational. You can only do it under illusions. You know, you could do it if you have an illusion that it's not going to be so costly, for example. Or you could do it under the illusion that you're destined to succeed, you're on the side of history, etc. You know, if you have these various illusions, then such a struggle might make sense, but it doesn't make sense. The transition cost thesis says it doesn't make sense just from a narrow economic point of view. So let's kind of look at the argument that's involved here. First, the conditions for class compromise. Shavorsky's argument is grounded in what I think we could call some foundational facts about capitalism. So the basic argument goes something like this. It is a fundamental fact of capitalism that economic growth and innovation comes out of private profits. As long as you're playing the game of capitalism, that's the game we're in, right? Then it is the case that economic growth and innovation comes out of private profits. Doesn't come out of primarily out of other mechanisms. Of course, in concrete capitalist societies, there's lots of other stuff going on. State-funded research in universities is pretty important, it turns out, for innovation. A lot of innovation that we see in capitalist firms are parasitic on basic research that's not done in the capitalist way. You know, so actual capitalist societies are not purely capitalist. They also have state-run research centers. And a state-run research center might be good for capitalism, but it is not itself a capitalist form of research. Whereas the research and development department of IBM or Sony or General Motors, those are investments. The capitalist firm decides how much of its profits to allocate towards its innovation departments, and they develop various new technologies. But it turns out that a lot of that development that takes place within the R&D departments of corporations is parasitic upon more fundamental research that's being done in universities. Just as an aside on this point, this isn't directly relevant to the discussion today, in the last 40 years, certainly in the course of my career, this boundary between what universities do and what private corporations do has gotten much blurrier. universities have become very concerned about getting patents, for example, on innovations that are directly the result of research in university labs. And the professors who do that research are much more concerned about setting up, you know, biotech firms, startups of various sorts, in which they have a stake so that they can capitalize on their own innovations. And the emergence of these hybrid forms, public-private partnerships in effect, where universities and professors and government-funded labs and private startups get all mushed together in ways which 50 years ago would have been thought of as sordid and corrupt, but which are now encouraged by universities. It's universities then as profit centers. And that language then infects the rest of the universities. The language of the deans these days are to think about different departments just in the hard core of the arts and sciences, you know, the hard core of the academic world, to think of them as profit centers in terms of how much money do they bring into the university and things like that. It's really a serious distortion of traditional academic values. That's an aside. But still, I think the fundamental fact of capitalism is that the dynamism of capitalism, its growth and innovation, it comes out of privately generated profits. This, I think, has very deep implications for working class formations. And this can be summarized in these four claims. First, workers' present welfare depends upon two central variables: the level of productivity of the economy and workers' ability to resist exploitation, that is, to capture part of the surplus produced. So if you have a very high productivity economy and workers have no capacity to capture any of the surplus, then their material conditions of life are much worse than if they are able, because of their collective strength or because of the scarcity of their labor under tight labor markets. There's all sorts of reasons to have part of the surplus redistributed to workers in the form of wages, to just make it a kind of technical point, wages above the competitive equilibrium. You can call those, if you want to use some technical language, you can call those employment rents. You can use the word rent to describe a component of the wage which is above a purely competitive equilibrium wage, so above it, and that represents a redistribution of the social surplus. Or in the case of workers, you could say it implies that they have reduced the rate of exploitation. They recapture part of the surplus which they themselves produce in the form of higher wages. Okay. Workers' present welfare depends upon these two things. Workers' future welfare depends upon two processes. Capitalists' present investments out of the surplus they appropriate, because that determines growth. And workers' capacity to appropriate future streams of wages from productivity growth. So your future depends upon, is the economy growing and is it innovating? And what's your capacity for the future surpluses that get generated to be redistributed in part to workers? That redistribution of the fruits of productivity growth can either be in the form of higher wages or what's called the social wage. Another way you can gain from future growth is the way it's done under social democratic, you know, regimes, by having the state tax part of the social surplus and then use the state appropriated surplus to provide social insurance, public goods, other amenities, which become part of the standard of living of workers. Sometimes that's called the social wage. So you have the private wage that you acquire through the sale of your labor power and a social wage, which is a wage in the sense that it's part of your standard of living, contributes to the reproduction of your labor power. But the social wage is provided collectively, not individually. And that's actually, I think, at least as important it's not just that wages get pegged to productivity, that your wages at work go up as productivity goes up, but the social wage goes up as the society becomes richer and produces more surplus under higher productivity. The state's capacity to appropriate part of that surplus to meet common needs also increases. Okay, so there are these four propositions, but there's a dilemma. You can't maximize both number two and number four, it should say, because it's workers. It should be, you can't maximize both two. You can't maximize the amount of surplus. Oh, no, actually, right. No, it's two and three, sorry. It is two and three. You can't maximize how much of the surplus you workers manage to get now by being hyper-militant and forcing capitalists to raise their wages. You can't maximize that and maximize growth and innovation for future income. Because if you maximize your demands now for high wages, you're detracting from the capacity of capitalists to innovate. This generates a deep tension within working class struggles, because this is the form in which workers face a potential trade-off between present and future income in their struggles with capitalists. If you try to maximize your present income, you undercut the potential for rises in future income. This is like the perpetual trade-off inherent in every act of, in just the kind of ordinary common sense way, of balancing present consumption against future consumption. So this is the kind of collective version of an individual problem. If you increase your savings at the moment, in the present, in order to put your savings in a bank to get interest for the future, what you're doing is you're trading off present consumption for higher future consumption. Well, that's the individualistic version of this, where you decide how much you're going to save. The added complexity in this case is if workers moderate their wage demands so that capitalists have higher rates of profit, they're doing so in the hope that capitalists will invest that surplus in ways that will lead to higher future earnings for workers. So it's not, in the case of your own savings, you pull back on your present consumption knowing that the resources that you're not consuming, you will save for your future. Here, you're pulling back, workers are pulling back on their present consumption by not making maximum wage demands in the expectation that somebody else is going to save those profits by investing them for future growth and innovation. That makes the problem more difficult because of the conditionality of this whole process on struggle and uncertainty. Okay, so that's the background then for a question that Przeworski basically asks in his efforts to model these things. Let us suppose that workers are insufficiently powerful to overthrow capitalism. That's not possible. But they are powerful enough that they could win very large wage increases through their struggles. Would it be rational for them to do so? Is it rational for workers to struggle for the highest possible wage increases? Przeworski's answer is that the rationality of particular wage strategies of workers depends upon the likely response of capitalists to different levels of working class militancy. So, to maximize your wage gains requires a lot of militancy. You have to really fight hard to maximize your wage gains. The question is, how are capitalists going to respond to whatever level of militancy you choose? And we can then define the following categories. Optimal militancy is that level of militancy which generates the maximum sustainable positive trajectory of wages over time. That's optimal militancy. You know, you want, if you're the godlike impresario of working class struggles and you want to tell the working class in this kind of reified way what to do, you say, pick the level of militancy which generates the maximum sustainable positive trajectory of wages over time. Maximal militancy is the maximum achievable level of antagonistic struggle against capital at any given time. You know, let us suppose that no class compromise is possible, either because economic conditions don't allow it, or because the capitalist class is so short-sighted and selfish that they refuse ever to compromise. They prefer all-out class war. Under such conditions, Shavorsky argues, workers will do better by being maximally militant, by trying to obtain the maximum wage increase at every point in time. That's the best they can do, is to be maximally militant. The what one might want to call the hyper-radicalism thesis is that optimal militancy always equals maximum militancy. Class compromise is always a sham. And in radical circles, you know, in the labor movement, this is a not that unusual a stance. Whenever leaders make a compromise and come to, you know, agreements that involve concessions on both sides from their their maximum demands, there will be radicals who will say you're a sellout. You know, that you should always try to get the maximum gains possible. In social democratic countries, in the period of the kind of greatest stability of the social democratic class compromise, unions engaged in a practice that was called wage restraint, where unions played a crucial role in holding down wages, where they could have demanded more and gotten more, but they held down wages. And that was a big source of debate. Are the union leaders simply collaborating with capitalists and doing the work of capitalists? Shouldn't workers demand as high wages as they can get? And the answer was no, because this provides for the context of a stable deal where the trajectory over time for workers becomes stable, even though you restrain your militancy at every point in time. That then leads to the class compromise thesis. A class compromise means that in exchange for workers moderating their militancy, unions restrain the potential militancy. They don't strike at every opportunity. They don't push capitalists to the limit. Capitalists agree to reinvest part of the surplus and to give workers the fruits of this reinvestment in the form of productivity-based wage increases. The deal is, unions say, we won't push you to the wall. We won't strike to maximize our return, our gains. But in exchange, you promise that as productivity increases, wages will increase more or less in pace with productivity. Under such conditions, Shavorsky argues, the optimal strategy for workers is moderate militancy rather than maximum militancy. Sufficiently militant to ensure that capitalists abide by their side of the bargain, but not so militant as to threaten the compromise by squeezing the rate of profit. What's off in many analyses of the economic crisis of the 1970s, it's referred to as a profit squeeze crisis, in which the wages of workers had risen too rapidly and profits were being squeezed. The rate of exploitation was undermined. Profits were being squeezed by the tight labor markets of the 1960s, pushed wages up, and unions didn't play the role, in some places, the United States in particular, of restraining wages in the face of those tight labor markets. Whereas in the social democratic countries, unions did play that role. Wage restraint was particularly important in the period of very low unemployment, where tight labor markets would normally have pushed wages up. Well, that didn't happen, but it didn't happen because of the deal that was struck between labor and capital. The critical issue then is what determines the feasibility of this kind of class compromise. There are three kinds of issues here, I think. Time horizons, trust, and working class associational power. Time horizons, that's basically the issue of how far into the future do workers and capitalists make strategic calculations. Now, partially that's a question of preference. You know, that's one way of looking at it. Everybody has time preferences. To use, again, technical language, everyone has a discount rate. That's how much you value the future relative to the present. People have different time horizons in which they're prepared to make present choices. But it's also a question of the stability of the environment in which you're making your choices. You can't have a long time horizon unless you have some degree of confidence about the character of the future relative to the present. If you're in a period of tremendous volatility where everything seems up for grabs, where nothing is stable, you just can't predict the future consequences of present choices. And under conditions of extreme volatility, time horizons tend to get shorter. You know, you can only save for a rainy day, for example, if you believe that the banks are going to remain solvent and that money isn't going to be destroyed through inflation. If you can't save for a rainy day, which is, that expression is a long time horizon idea, right? That's invoking withholding your consumption now for future. If you don't know whether the rate of inflation is going to be 5% a year or 300% a year, you know, that just means you're just at a loss. What should I do? And so time horizons tend to be shortened when you have a lot of uncertainty and volatility. Time horizons can get shortened because of political instability as well, not just economic, and certainly geopolitical. If you feel that there's uncertainty about whether there's going to be wars, that certainly affects the time horizon in which you try to plan your present choices with respect to future possibilities. The more confident actors are about the predictability of the future, particularly in terms of these basic material economic interest issues, the longer into the future they're willing to make strategic calculations. So what Chvorsky has argued is that in advanced industrial capitalism, when he was writing about this in the 1980s, and I think it's still basically true in a lot of ways, there is generally a relatively long time horizon based on the historical experience of stable accumulation. Sure, there are crises, there are interruptions, but capitalism has been around now for a couple hundred years, and it still is a growth machine. And even if it enters into periods of crisis, mostly, I think, people feel if they're going to say, well, what do you think things will be like 20 years from now? They would say there's going to be large corporations, there's going to be labor markets, there's going to be high levels of productivity. You know, there's a general sense that the world isn't going to be turned upside down. Now, that may be somewhat less true today than it was 25 years ago when 30 years ago when Chvorsky wrote Capitalism and Social Democracy. That's one interpretation of what's going on globally now, the combination of global warming, which is certainly a destabilizing prediction about the future, and the exhaustion of neoliberalism and its crisis tendencies. There's less feeling of confidence that we can predict something about the future based on the stability of the past. Yeah, but that's the time horizon element. That's one ingredient. The longer the time horizon, the more favorable the conditions for a class compromise. The easier it is to trade off the present for the future. The second thing is trust, which I think probably is more important. And the state plays a particularly crucial role in being the guarantor of trust. Even if workers believe that they can predict the future state of the economy, they're unlikely to be comfortable with a class compromise if they feel they cannot trust capitalists to follow through with their promises. And the same is true for capital. it's important to see this as a problem both ways. If the capitalist class feels that the working class formations are filled with radical hotheads who will call wildcat strikes in violation of agreements whenever they see a vulnerability and an ability to win, they're less likely to form deals as well. You know, the stability of a compromise depends upon trust. And because this is a class relation that's built around antagonistic interests, trust is often a very difficult thing to achieve. Now, it's noteworthy in these respects that trust between capital and labor is often more successfully forged within very old-fashioned family firms, where the leadership of the firm is really a known persons, and you can see what their behavior was in the past, and therefore the willingness to trust their agreements for the future, you know, has some grounding. There's a very interesting story about a grocery store chain in the Northeast, Market Basket, I think it was called. Not sure what the, may not have the name quite right. It's in Massachusetts primarily. A small grocery chain, you know, with 30 or 40 stores, family firm, in which two cousins were joint owners of the firm. The cousin who was the CEO had 49% of the stock, and the other cousin had 51%. And the owner decided a long time ago that he was going to run his grocery store chain as if he really cared about the employees. They were paid way above the prevailing wage for grocery store workers. They had full benefits. There were all sorts of completely atypical practices in the firm. And they had extremely low turnover. Grocery stores typically have high turnover. They're not very good jobs. These were really good jobs in this chain, and it did not maximize profits. The rate of profit on the invested capital was lower than typical for grocery stores. Well, the non-CEO cousin, who wasn't paying much attention apparently, figured this out. And so as the majority stock owner, he had 51%, he fired the CEO. He fired his cousin and tried to turn the grocery store into a conventional chain in order to raise the rate of profit. The employees then went on strike. There was no union, but they went on strike to rehire the CEO. That's pretty weird. Workers going on strike to defend the job of their boss. And they organized consumer boycotts of the stores, and the loyal clientele of these stores followed the lead. So the stores were going precipitously down, and it was ultimately resolved by the good cousin, buying out the bad cousin and restoring the previous regime in the store. Well, that's possible. You can do that in a family firm. It's much, much harder to behave that way in an investor firm with, you know, impersonal institutions that invest their capital in the firm and who move their capital around from one firm to another depending upon the rate of return. And if there's an exit of shareholders from a firm and the stock price goes down, that opens up the firm to what's called a hostile takeover, because some venture capitalist or private equity firm or some other nefarious actors with a lot of capital on hand will see this corporation as a grossly undervalued asset relative to what it could be if it was run properly. You know, that's a typical thing. That's the story that's told about how stock markets discipline corporations. Well, there's no stock market in a privately held family firm, so they're not disciplined by a stock market. Their only requirement for survival is that they make a positive rate of profit. And this cousin who ran the CEO, he said, I don't need to maximize profits. I just need enough profits to live well enough, which is true. You know, he wasn't under any driving force to raise the rate of profit. Okay, well, that has to do with trust. That's the second element. What Szaborski argues, then, is that because of the antagonistic character of the class relations within capitalist firms, it's pretty hard in general to establish robust, long-term trust relations in a firm simply on the basis of what goes on inside of the firm. And that's why the state becomes so important. The real site of class compromise is a political compromise with the state. The institutions of bourgeois democracy, especially under the guidance of social democratic parties, provides the setting for the necessary reciprocity and trust to develop. That's really the key mechanism. It's not good faith. It's not mainly goodwill and good faith bargaining inside of corporations. It's not that that doesn't play some role. You know, you can have corporations like Walmart that have historically been extremely vicious and hard-hitting in their aggressive opposition to class compromise, and other corporations that are more amenable, but it's not mainly that that's the issue. It's the political context in which deals can be struck. And that means that the, in many ways, the primary form of this connection between wages and productivity growth comes through the social wage, not just the private wage. A lot of it is mediated through the way the state acts as a redistributive mechanism. And the trust in the state's capacity to do that would be typically stronger than the trust in the willingness of capitalists to do it directly, because it's mediated by a political party with a particular platform and a particular organizational foundation. Finally, there's time horizons and trust, and the third component, and this is the component that I've mostly focused on in my work on class compromise, is the associational power of the working class. The class compromise thesis suggests a particular relationship between the strength of the working class and the interests of capital. My elaborated version of this is in the picture at the bottom of the page here. And I discuss this at length and in detail in the chapter on class compromise in Understanding Class. So the basic way to think about this picture is the following. First, ignore the shaded areas. And ignore the second hump. Just sort of put your hand over the picture. And initially, let's just look at this part. So this is the interests of capitalists. And this is the power of workers. So the standard way that both Marxists and neoclassical economists would think about this connection is that it's more or less an inverse relationship, right? As workers get stronger, this interferes with the autonomy and the capacity of capitalists. So there's an inverse relationship, negatively sloped. That would be the kind of standard view. What the Szaborski view says is that if working class power gets to a certain level, the curve turns upwards. So it's true that when you go from extremely low to moderate working class power, workers' ability to disrupt things undermines the interests of capital, but they're not strong enough to actually help capitalists solve any important problems. They don't have a kind of collective capacity to be full partners and collaborators with capital. They only have a capacity to force capitalists to make concessions by causing trouble. But there is at some point an upward slope to the curve. This part of the curve is the zone of positive class compromise. Class compromises that occur in this part of the curve are negative class compromises. So what's the difference? A negative class compromise is a compromise, that is, there's give and take, there's concessions made, but it's the concessions are always made in the context of threats and sanctions. Think of it that what is a threat? It's the threat of imposing a cost. So it's, you know, like a using a military metaphor, there's a balance of forces, and there's an assessment that it would be too costly to keep struggling for a complete and total victory over the opposing force. It's better to just make a deal because of the damage that each can cause each other. It's mutual damage. Capitalists can damage labor by refusing ever to concede and forcing workers into destitution, but that risks the solvency of their own business. They can't stay out of the market indefinitely. If workers are strong enough to prevent strikebreakers from entering the firm, capitalists can't simply hire new workers to replace the striking workers. You get a balance of, in a conflict, it's kind of like a stalemate on a battlefield. That's negative class compromise. And negative class compromise, of course, are important. Negative class compromises are the kind of bread and butter compromises of capitalism. Negative class compromises, however, are always unstable because of the ebbs and flows of your capacity to impose damage. They're unstable from the point of view of capital because there are moments when capitalists become vulnerable, you know, where a working class strike really does hurt them more than other times. If you have an economic downturn and you have a strike, in a way, the strike is okay for capitalists. They can just simply stop production for a while because they're not going to be making any good profits anyway. When it turns out that when you have a boom and you're really making lots of profits, that's actually when a strike is most effective, typically. Because under those conditions, capitalists are risking making lots of profits in a period where lots of profits are makeable. And they also have a capacity to make concessions. You know, so negative class compromises tend to be unstable. Positive class compromises are a different sort of thing. What positive class compromises amount to is a circumstance where the working class is sufficiently well organized, sufficiently powerful, with enough solidarity and enough capacity that they can offer something positive for capitalists. Not just, we won't cause you pain, but we can offer you something. They can help capital solve certain problems, which are difficult for capitalists to solve on their own. The classic example is wage restraint. So what's how to think about wage restraint? So here's the story. You have a tight labor market. What does that mean? It means it's hard for capitalists to hire new workers to fill positions. They want to expand production. The easiest way to expand production would be to hire some more workers. But there's not that many workers available. Unemployment is low. You have a tight labor market. So what do capitalists do in conditions where it's hard to find workers? The typical thing they do is raise their wages in an effort to lure workers away from other firms. When wages go up, it's not primarily to lure the unemployed into employment or to lure people who are out of the labor force, who dropped out completely, you know, somebody who retired and then gets lured back because of high wages. No, what raising wages does is poach workers from other firms. When you have a tight labor market, wages go up as a way of inducing people to leave one job for another. Well, that creates a kind of arms race among capitalists. if people are leaving my firm because they're getting higher wages elsewhere, I'm forced to raise wages. You get an arms race, and that's when you get general wage increases, which can become wage increases above the rate of productivity increase. And ultimately, that can create a profit squeeze, right? So it's given that we're in a capitalist economy, it's destabilizing to have wage inflation being driven by competition between firms. When unions are sufficiently strong, what they can say to capitalists is, we will prevent poaching. We'll prevent wage increases. We'll create a bargain that's centralized especially, where wage increases are blocked. Firms simply aren't allowed to do it. That's solving a free rider problem among capitalists. You see that? That what you're doing is solving a problem that's pretty hard for capitalists to solve. They could form a cartel, but you know, there's all sorts of problems with them forming a cartel where they agree to not raise wages. You could have the state simply impose a wage freeze. That happens sometimes. It's much better if the working class itself imposes the wage restraint on itself through its collective organization. That has a higher legitimacy, it's less politically vulnerable, and it represents this deal, a social compact. But for that to work, the labor unions have to be pretty strong. They have to somehow prevent subgroups of workers going on a wildcat strike to break the wage restraint. We can earn more. What are you doing? You're keeping our wages down. Well, workers have to understand, yes, we're keeping your wages down, but this is for the long-term trajectory. It's a positive class compromise. What you're getting out of this is stable employment rather than ups and downs in unemployment. You're getting stable employment, and you're getting the kind of economic stability that makes possible a large social wage. And that was the deal that was struck in basically, social democratic countries in the clearest way. That deal was struck even in less social democratic countries in different ways. That's one of a variety of things that you can get in this upward sloping part of the curve. Now, I carry this analysis a little further than Szaborski. I also argue that this is the power of the working class, and this goes from low to, we can call this moderately high. And then if we carry it on to extremely high, think of this as class-wide collective solidarity of the working class as a whole, the curve turns down again. So this creates a particular interesting sort of problem, that capitalists are happy. They'd rather be up here. This is the sort of capitalist utopia is up there. The social democratic utopia is right here. Right, the social democratic utopia is to be at the maximum strength of labor and the collective organizations of popular forces compatible with the reproduction of capitalism, which is right here. Capitalists would prefer an atomized working class where they can just do what they want. Revolutionaries want to move the situation to here, where you have sufficient power to actually overcome capitalism. What the social democratic compromise does is create a set of rules of the game which makes it hard to really tip over the top and hard to really get past the trough. So they make this as the historically accessible region of the curve. This we can think of as the region for moves in the, moves in the game. And these are social democratic rules. And then there's another set of
more fundamental rules, which are the basic capitalism defining rules. This part of the curve is excluded because
you have to be playing a different game to get there. The, if you will, the constituting rules of capitalism exclude this part of the curve. This is the part of the curve where you have constitutional protections of private property, freedom of exchange, a whole variety of capitalism-defining rules. These are the rules that define the welfare state, the redistributive capacities, the rules of association for workers. This exclusion here is the basic democratic game rules. So if we think of the game itself as democratic capitalism, as opposed to authoritarian capitalism, there are certain rules that would really make it hard to push the power of workers to zero because of basic rights of association and civil liberties. Those are the defining rules that make democratic capitalism capitalism, democratic, and these are the defining rules that make democratic capitalism capitalist. The variability of rules, therefore, is in these two zones. In the United States, these were shifted this way. So we had less favorable rules that made it harder to move up the positive class compromise slope, and we had more favorable rules for capital to make it easier to move up the downward part, sloping part of the curve. In the part of the did I assign the last chapter on class compromise in the era of stagnation and crisis? Forget if I assigned that as well. In the book, in Understanding Class, the last chapter of the book asks the question, what happens to these curves in the era of neoliberalism and crisis? And I make two kinds of arguments, which are purely theoretical because I don't have any empirical, really strong empirical evidence to support the claims. One thing that happens is that this peak goes down. So there's something going on in the world of globalized financialization that makes the positive class compromise part of the curve shallower. So one way you can compare different political economic contexts is by theorizing the shape of the curve itself. So under high mobility of capital globally and high financialization of capitalism, the upward sloping part of the curve goes down. Capitalists get less benefit out of strongly organized working classes in any one place because they can always move their capital to another place where they can get higher rates of profit. At least that was true for a period. It's not so obvious that's true now. I mean, in the current conditions where there are huge piles of profits piling up because capitalists can't find profitable outlets of investment, it's not so obvious how big an advantage it continues to be that they can move their capital anywhere relative to creating good conditions for accumulation in particular places. So it's not so obvious that this is permanently depressed. But one view is that this has been pushed down by financialization and globalization. The neoliberalism, which changed the rules of the game, as in Wisconsin, affects where these zones of exclusion are and has moved this to the left. To the left on the... It would have been better if in the French Revolution, if the radicals had been on the right of the chamber rather than the left of the chamber, then our language would have been, we would all be right-wingers. And it would make this chart easier because we could say moving to the right would be moving in the more progressive direction. That's a little historical anecdote if which might have been completely obscure if you didn't know it already. The only reason we associate the word left with progressive and right with reactionary, the only reason is because of the seating plan in the National Assembly after the, you know, the early 1790s in the French Revolution, where people, where the Girondins sat and the Jacobins sat, you know, just where they sat. In case you thought there was some deeper... You know, I don't know the answer to whether it was the left or... It must be the left or right from the point of view of the people sitting in the chamber, not the people observing the chamber. So it's not stage left. It would be... Right, okay, enough of that. All right, so this is the general framework then for thinking about class compromise. Class compromises of one sort or another are the normal state of affairs in mature capitalist countries. They can be positive or negative, they can be strong or weak, but all-out class war is not the normal state of affairs. That is, mobilization for struggle in which all gains and losses depend upon confrontation is not the standard way in which class relations get organized collectively in mature capitalist countries. But the conditions for stable, positive class compromises have certainly declined. The task for progressives, one way of thinking about it is the task is to try to restore those conditions, to struggle over the rules of the game and over the shape of the curve so as to make stable, positive class compromise more possible. That's as opposed to saying that the task for progressives is now is primarily how do we escape the game altogether? How do we escape the game altogether is the problem of how do you get out of capitalism and go to socialism. We will, at the last weekend of the class when we have our retreat, we will directly engage that problem as a serious problem. Just to foreshadow, I think the prospects of having a long-term strategy that makes socialism possible are better, not worse, under conditions of a positive class compromise. That is, when there's a positive class compromise, it's easier, not harder, to begin to build the kinds of institutions which themselves prefigure a socialist alternative and erode the dominance of capitalism. Now that's a kind of ass-backward way of arguing for most Marxists who would say that severe crisis is the optimal condition for a transition to socialism. When capitalism is in its biggest disarray and falling apart, that's when you can have a transition to socialism. My argument is that under those severe crisis conditions, attempts at a transition to socialism in developed capitalist countries under those conditions is more likely to lead to authoritarian statism, highly repressive forms of capitalism that can reproduce the system through despotism rather than an effective strategy for actually breaking out of capitalism. And the only strategy for actually breaking out of capitalism has to be one that erodes the dominance of capitalism in a stable structure where the ecology of different economic forms makes possible the building of alternatives. Well, that's prefiguring a point that will be hopefully a contentious debate among people with different perspectives at the very end of the semester. Here I just want to review Shavorsky's argument about the difficulty of breaking with capitalism under democratic conditions. And this is the transition cost problem. So the basic problem that he's addressing is this. Class compromises is better for workers than hyper-militancy, Shavorsky argues, within the capitalist rules of the game. As long as you're playing the game of capitalism, that's what you should strive for. Because that's the situation in which you have the greatest stability for the realization of working class interests over time. And if you can't get a positive class compromise, you should strive to create the conditions for a positive class compromise. So class compromise, as long as you're stuck within capitalism, is the optimal thing to do. But this raises the question, why don't workers simply opt for socialism? If it's indeed true, as Marxists claim, that a democratically organized economy where workers have the capacity to set priorities and allocate investments through as yet unspecified institutional means would actually make for a higher quality of life and the better realization of working class interests, why do workers stay within the game of capitalism? Why don't they engage in revolutionary struggle to change the game itself? The basic argument for, the basic explanation that Shavorsky argues for why workers don't attempt a rupture with capitalism has to do with the distinction between what's good for workers being in a socialist economy versus what's good for workers going from here to there. This is the problem of what's called transition costs. And that's represented in the figure here, which is also taken from the chapter. I don't know if the transition cost argument is in the Understanding Class book. I don't remember whether I...
It's in the
AJS. It's in the AJS, yeah. I mean, there's an... I mean, I have. It's in Envisioning Real Utopias. In the chapter on ruptural transformation is where this particular picture is laid out in Envisioning Real Utopias. So here's the basic story. Here we have a graph where the vertical axis is what's good for workers, just in standard material welfare terms. So you can pack as much as you like in there. It can be simple income, it can be income plus leisure, it can be income plus leisure plus autonomy, you know. This isn't highly sensitive to what you're putting in the graph. But just think of it in ordinary terms, the standard of living of workers. If you put in everything about the quality of life, well, it becomes more complicated. Let's think of this in material terms, though. The stuff that you're buying when you earn your wages. So the idea is that within capitalism, over time, the material welfare of workers tends to go up slowly. That's true, by the way, even in the last 40 years where we've had this period of tremendous stagnation. The average worker in the United States lives better today than 40 years ago. That is, the material standards of living of workers are better today than they were 40 years ago. We've had wage stagnation, but that doesn't mean we've had a stagnation of material standards of living. If you take any list of things which define your material standard of living, so indoor plumbing, square feet per person in your house, quality of televisions, quality of the cars you drive. I mean, you just put anything on that list you want, and the average person in every developed capitalist country is higher now than they were 40 years ago, in spite of stagnation. There's all sorts of complicated reasons why that's true. You have to actually go pretty far down the income distribution scale for it not to be true. You know, it's if you go down to the bottom 10 or 15%, it's not true. People's actual material standards of life are worse now for the bottom 15, maybe 20% of the population in the United States. But for 75%, in terms of a vector of material, you know, conditions of life, standards of living are higher. Now, there's a lot of complicated reasons for that. One reason is, for example, family sizes are smaller. So when you talk about stagnating wages, if your family size is on average smaller, it means that your material levels of consumption per capita are higher than they were before. But there's also the fact, as we all know, that there's a whole array of things that people care a lot about that just didn't exist 40 years ago. You know, people have smartphones. Everybody has smartphones now. And if you ask people about what things they would be willing to give up if they needed to because of economic constraints, smartphones are low on the list. They really want to keep their smartphones. Now, that could be they've just been seduced by consumerism. You know, I'm not saying that this reflects a deep understanding of the quality of life. But the fact of the matter is, the material standards of living of most people, in spite of stagnation, have gone up. And that's one of the reasons why I think, in fact, capitalism is as robust as it is in terms of people's feelings about alternatives. It's not that as a result of stagnation we have starvation, and we have an increase of homelessness, but it's still a few percent of the population at most. It's not 30%. It's not like in the Great Depression, you know, where you had actual starvation on or serious malnutrition on a large scale occurring. So there's all sorts of reasons for this. I mean, I'm not saying this in praise of the wonders of capitalism, but it's a fact of capitalism that it does provide slow, but so far reasonably predictable rises in the standards, material standards of living of people. Yeah.
To what extent can we give capitalism credit for this, without really considering at the heart of it the advancements in human intelligence?
Well, it's true that I don't think it's just because of capitalism. I mean, we have smartphones because human beings are incredibly creative and innovative. They have deployed this creativity and innovation under capitalist conditions in which it's the production of a commodity in the market that translates that creativity into the standards of living of people. And that's the way it happens in capitalism. And that means that, and that's why it helps to validate capitalism. It's not that you wouldn't, if we had a democratic and egalitarian economic structure, it's not that things like smartphones or other things wouldn't also be creatively deployed. It's a prediction, though, rather than a well-established hypothesis that the rate of development of those things would be the same or higher. That's extremely hard to give any, you know, strong empirical grounding for. It's not impossible. There are arguments why the rate of innovation would be at the same or higher. It would just be different. You know, you'd be innovating to meet human needs and to increase human flourishing more than you'd be innovating for the purpose of maximizing short-term profits. So that there'd be different impulses. But exactly how that plays out, you know, the counterfactual is pretty uncertain. Okay, but the basic point here, and the reason why this is important, the prediction for the future is that capitalism is going to continue to do more or less what it's done in the past. That's the way most people are going to predict the future. You just sort of extrapolate from the past. And while the rate of increase of material welfare of the average person might flatten out, and there would be lots of ups and downs. You know, we had the financial crisis of 2008. Nevertheless, you have this capitalist trajectory that would look something like this. You could make this a horizontal line if you think it's going to be flat in the future. You could even make it begin to decline. The crucial question then is the rate of decline relative to the counterfactual. Okay, let me just go through this chart, though, so you see what the chart's doing. We are on the left-hand, at the moment, we're on the left-hand part of this curve, and we're looking into the future. And we're asking ourselves the question, we're the central committee, right, of the new political movement to try to transform capitalism. And we're saying, okay, if we mobilize effectively and we convince everybody of our truths, at some point we're going to be able to begin to seriously challenge power. And let's call that, and we eventually gain state power, because the transition to socialism requires the use of the power of the state. We gain state power. It could either be, let's say it's through elections. You know, we're in a democratic society. It's quite implausible that we'd be able to gain state power in the United States by mobilizing a revolutionary army to defeat the American army and take over the state. So we do mobilize a radical party. We are able to gain state power. And we start legislating the key institutional components of a socialist alternative. And that's this point that says the beginning of the transition to socialism. So what from that point on, we're predicting the future, right? So we're our expectations beforehand are predictions about what's going to happen at that point. The top graph is what I call the socialism fantasy path. That's the idea that it would that there's any conceivable way that you could begin a transition to socialism through the seizure of state power. This would apply whether it be revolutionary or reformist, whether it be through elections or through a putsch, or however you want to imagine this happening. The fantasy path is that it's costless, that immediately things are better for the working class as a whole and for the median worker, you know, the person in the middle in particular. That's a fantasy. I think anybody who gives this any serious thought, it's a fantasy. Shevorsky's argument around this is we don't even have to consider the armed resistance of capitalists or the civil war that might get launched. He's just talking about what is the likely trajectory, even if it's done under smooth democratic conditions, under the most positive possibilities. So if you add violence and chaos and civil war to this, the story gets even worse. So let's just assume that everybody agrees to abide by the rules of the democratic game. You win an election, you start instituting the transition to socialism, and everybody opposed to it just abides by the rules. They don't attempt to overthrow the system in a counter-revolution. Okay, even with that, the socialism fantasy path doesn't hold. And the reason is that as soon as you announce that we are transitioning to a democratically egalitarian economic structure, the ordinary mundane business decisions of capitalists will be dramatically changed. You can't instantaneously jump from a market-based system with private ownership and complicated commodity chains and credit institutions that provide long-term and short-term credit for the purchase of inputs to complicated production systems. You can't just snap your fingers and have that all become democratically allocated. No. It's going to be a process. It's going to take time. You have to build these institutions. And there's going to be a period, therefore, in which capitalists control capital. It's there. They own it. And in which they're going to respond. Even if they don't attempt to mobilize an investment strike in the sense of coordinating their response, they will individually respond by disinvesting. The result is what I call the socialist optimistic path. The optimistic path is that once you announce a transition to socialism, things are going to get worse. That the announcement, you know, the political mobilization and the emergence of this new institution building project is going to make life worse for most people, because there's going to be huge economic disruption. There's going to be large withdrawals of capital. There's going to be a failure of credit institutions. There's going to be disruptions in the supply of inputs and therefore in the production of outputs. There'll be disruptions of international trade. There'll be all sorts of things which will disrupt the smooth functioning of the still market economy and still capitalist-dominated market economy in the period of transition. That's called the transition trough. Now, the democratic socialist ideal is then that eventually that trough hits bottom, and then the new institutional configurations, which allow for smooth supply chains, smooth forms of new socialist credit institutions, new forms of socialist integration and production, begin to dominate. The ability of these collective forms of investment to provide for the needs of people increases. And eventually the socialist path of material well-being is higher than the capitalist path. That's the optimistic claim, is the new equilibrium that you eventually reach, you're better off in socialism than in capitalism. But in the transition, there'll be a period where you're worse off than in capitalism. Yeah?
I'm just curious about what happened to Sweden, because it is said that its country has shown some symptoms of democratic socialism.
Right. So Sweden and Northern Europe in general, but Sweden is often taken as the archetype. Norway cheats because it has oil. You know, it has an exogenous source of wealth that the state owns and which it uses quite judiciously, but it makes it way easier for Norway to manage all this. Sweden is a capitalist country. It's not a socialist country. Investment is controlled overwhelmingly by private investors. Swedish corporations are very large. Indeed, the concentrations of wealth in Sweden are every bit as unequal as they are in any other capitalist country. It's, you know, it has a very wealthy capitalist class. What's distinctive about Sweden is that alongside the dominance of capitalism in the economy, there's been a extremely coherent, in the past, state organized under social democratic principles that appropriates a significant part of the surplus generated by the capitalist economy and uses it for a variety of purposes, some of which are really non-capitalist purposes, some of which is to support capitalism, but some of which is really to provide for basic needs, to improve the quality of life, to create a market-independent, decommodified quality of life for people. That balance between the very large state sector of provision of direct needs and the pretty conventional capitalist sector of investment to maximize profit returns, that balance was orchestrated under a variety of social democratic rules of the game, and pretty successfully for a long time. That particular configuration had a severe crisis in the early 1990s. There had been previous things that had occurred that kind of eroded some aspects of its institutional structure, but it had a really bad blow in the early 1990s with the financial crisis in Sweden. And the Social Democratic Party and the I think there was a kind of consensus on this, basically adopted neoliberal ideas about how to get out of that crisis. Now, when you apply neoliberalism to a society that had such an expansive state, I think 45% of GDP was taxed, close to 50%. You know, very high proportion of the total income of the economy was taxed by the state. They were from such a high platform that even after 25 years now of neoliberalism, it's still a much more expansive, welfare-providing, risk-reducing insurance state than most other countries. But there's been a big erosion of it over the last 25 years. Sweden has a project of having for-profit corporations run public schools. You know, in Sweden, the sort of nightmare vision that we're talking about now with DeVos here, that it's a nice neoliberal idea. Let private corporations run schools. Well, that was introduced into Sweden. It's not the dominant form of schooling, but it still exists in Sweden. Which is, from a social democratic point of view, kind of horrifying, this kind of core function of the public sector for the common good, the idea that a for-profit corporation can do a better job.
at doing this. Yeah.
So if social democracy means that you have a version of capitalist state that appropriates social surplus through higher rates of taxation, then reinvested in public investment, in public good, then any estate with some kind of enlightened manager, estate managers would be able to, you know, would be a kind of social democracy. Let's say in Canada, if you have estate managers who are caring and who invest in public infrastructure, you know, the way Norway does, the way Sweden does, right, they would be called social democracy.
Right.
Universal healthcare, free schooling.
Yeah, so it, that's true. That I like to think of this as an aspect of the state, which is not strictly an aspect of it as a capitalist state. We'll get into this discussion next in the next couple of weeks when we talk about this concept. It's a very tricky concept of the capitalist state, as opposed to the state in capitalist society. So my argument will be that the state in capitalist society is simultaneously a capitalist and non-capitalist state. That is, it has apparatuses, it has properties, it has dimensions which follow a capitalist logic in the service of reproducing capitalism, but it also contains elements, particularly when the state is under democratic forms, which have a very non-capitalist character to it, which respond to non-capitalist needs and interests, and in which the exact balance between that is variable. So the Swedish state, under strong social democratic rule, when the Social Democratic Party itself was deeply connected to the labor movement, and the labor movement was deeply connected to the working class, so you had all of these lines of connection, which meant that the parts of the state which were serving this broad social good purposes were not fully subordinated to capitalist interests. So let me just finish this chart. It's discussed in the readings, and we'll come. So the pessimistic path, which is the one that the counter-revolutionaries all argue for, is that as soon as you begin this transition to socialism, things are just going to get worse forever. All right. So that's the counter-revolutionaries say it's the pessimistic path. The serious good faith socialists give you the optimistic path. At the beginning of the transition, they both agree that things are getting worse. Things are getting worse. The question then is how long is this transition trough and how deep is it? And how credible is the claim when you're approaching the bottom of the trough that things are going to get better soon? So just think of this in terms of election cycles. If the transition trough is 20 years, and election cycles are every 2 years for Congress and every 4 years for president if you're in the American system or whatever. You know, you have an election cycle. And you have one election cycle that occurs at the beginning of the transition trough. You have one election cycle that launches the break. 4 years later, you have another election cycle where you're in the midst of this trough. And the socialists are saying, hang in there. We know things are tough. We predicted they would be tough. They're going to turn around soon. And their majority of support is lower in the second election because the argument of the opposition, no, things are just going to keep getting worse, has some face validity to it. You know, that's the way things have been for the last 4 years. Things have been getting worse. But you survive that first election. Well, if the trough continues, it gets harder and harder to survive subsequent elections. And this is under the assumption that there's a unified class base, the working class. What happens if you have middle class and working class, if you have contradictory class locations, et cetera? All of this, Szaborski argues, makes the idea of a democratic transition to socialism extremely problematic in this ruptural form where you have a break and try to build the alternative institutions. The prediction then is that at some point in this transition, either you abandon the democratic rules of the game, that is, you cancel elections, or you repress parties that are opposed to you, and therefore you're not in a transition to a democratic form of an alternative, or you have to abandon socialism. But you can't maintain sufficiently long time the democratic form and a socialist transition to survive the transition trough.
And that then makes class compromise within capitalism even more important, because it's the best you can do. Well, that's the Shavorsky analysis. We will return to this theme at the end of the semester when we really try to grapple with that pessimism to see if indeed there are ways of thinking about transformation that take this pessimism seriously but provide a way of reconstructing a transition logic. Okay. See you for the state next week. Yeah, hand back papers to your colleagues. I'm not going to write any comments on your comments, but I do like to have some evidence that you've actually done it. So for my record keeping, as the authoritarian leader of this collective and my ability to impose sanctions if you haven't done your homework. So do give me evidence that you've done it, but I won't be writing comments on your comments.
Yeah, sure, I'll send them.